Tim Cowdery is going to start us out in the next presentation, and Rich is going to follow along, Rich Soule. Tim is with the USGS. If you don't know Tim, he works here locally with the USGS. And Rich is with the Minnesota Department of Health. And together they're going to talk on nitrate loading and fate in shallow groundwater near Cold Spring, Minnesota. I think Tim is going to begin.
This is primarily Rich's talk, and I'm just going to kind of do a little preamble to kind of talk a little bit about groundwater age dating and nitrate quantification that you can do with a lot of the data that comes from that. And we did this technique and did a nitrate mass balance in an area just north of Perham, Minnesota. And Rich took that kind of same idea and applied it to an area in Cold Spring, and he'll be talking about that in detail. So I wanted to start with this slide because this is kind of the whole question of land use and water quality is really what we're talking about with this nitrate issue. And it's a pretty simple system. You know, you have some land use that contributes some amount of nitrate at land surface, hits the water table, and at some point later on, after maybe some transformations in the groundwater flow path, you end up finding that nitrate at wells. And which well you're looking at makes a big difference in what you find. So if you're looking at a monitoring well that's installed at the water table, the stuff that is at the water table, if it has a 5-foot screen, let's say, is from 0 to 10 years old. Whereas if you're looking at a farmer's well that's many feet below the water table and has a much longer screen, you're looking at much older water. So when you start trying to think about what land use is responsible for the nitrate that you find in that water, you have to start asking yourself, well, how old is the water? What was the land use 50 years ago if you sampled this well versus what was the land use 1 to 5 years ago if you sampled this well? And you pretty quickly come to a point where you want to start doing a mass balance on nitrogen, where you want to say, okay, how much mass of nitrogen came in at the surface over a period of years? What happened to that nitrogen as it flowed along the groundwater flow path? And what kinds of water got integrated into this well screen when you sampled it and pumped it out? So that, in order to answer a lot of those questions, you really need to know how old that water is. And we have applied, we did a lot of this work in Perham in the mid-90s, and from about the early 90s until today, we've used a lot of trace gas concentrations in the atmosphere to look at dating groundwater with high accuracy. The first three tracers here, CFC 11, 12, and 13, are refrigerants that are now banned in the United States, but they increased in concentration in the atmosphere from about the 1940s until about the mid to late 90s. And so if you assume that the precipitation falling through the atmosphere equilibrated with the atmospheric concentrations and then entered the groundwater and didn't change, and you can measure the concentrations of this stuff, you can come up with a really accurate date of when that water entered the ground on the order of 1 to 2 years. Since these things have been banned, the curves in the atmosphere have really flattened out, and you can't really use these for very modern water anymore, but we have other trace gases which are at much lower concentrations that we're now able to use, SF6, and I don't even know what the name of that compound is, but we can measure that. And these are both used in industrial processes. The concentrations of these compounds in the atmosphere are about 100 times lower than the CFCs. So when we're doing age dating with these compounds, we're assuming that these compounds are in equilibrium with the atmosphere at the pressures and temperatures at the time that the precipitation was falling through the air, and that these gases, there's no other sources for these gases except for the atmosphere. And so to use these to figure out what concentration should be here if you're in equilibrium, we need to know the pressure and temperature of the water when they equilibrated. And we do that with some other gases that we measure at the same time. Most importantly, argon and nitrogen. So this is just a graph of the current or the historical concentrations in the atmosphere, and you can see how these in the late 90s these curves really flattened out and have started to decline with the ban. But SF6 is still going up. Again, this is 100 times lower concentration. So this is on the order of 3 to 7 parts per trillion. So it's very small quantities. So we get the pressure from the recharge elevation. That's pretty straightforward unless you're in the mountains and you have a long flow path. We don't have that problem. The recharge temperature, though, is complicated. And it's complicated by the fact that we're using nitrogen, and there is another source for nitrogen, and that's denitrification. So we have to take that into account when we're looking at the age dates. Another complication is that you can get excess air in the recharge. As water is infiltrating into the ground, we kind of think of it as just filling all the voids and moving down as kind of a piston, but it doesn't do that. There's little tiny pore spaces that still have atmospheric gas in them, and those actually get trapped in the really uppermost superficial part of the groundwater. And so we have to also try to make estimates of excess air. So this is the plot that we get back from the lab. And I want to take just a few minutes to explain this plot. On the bottom axis, we have the concentration of nitrogen gas. On the vertical axis is the concentration of argon gas. If this water is in equilibrium with the atmosphere, it should lie on this line, the water equilibrium, water in equilibrium with the atmosphere. And the actual concentrations in the water will depend on the temperature. If we have excess air, those samples are going to plot in this direction off of each individual, off of any particular recharge temperature line, and pull the concentrations off to the upper right. If we have excess nitrogen from denitrification, it's going to pull the points this way straight horizontally across the plot. So what we do when we look at this stuff is the first thing you notice is these two guys down here, and you think, well, what's going on there? We certainly don't have a recharge temperature up in the 40 or 50 degree centigrade range. And we probably, you know, if we had excess air, we'd still have to move along these lines. So even if we had excess air, we still couldn't come back to a realistic temperature. So we have to invoke excess nitrogen from denitrification in order to get a sample plotting out here. Now, if we take the worst case scenario, which is the highest recharge temperature you can realistically imagine in Minnesota, like a 30 degree centigrade thunderstorm in the summer, you can pull this point straight back until it hits that 30 degree line, and then you can, in your best case scenario, you can assume it recharged at 30 degrees with 6 to 7 cc's excess air. And the difference between 25 milligrams per liter nitrate gas and 17 is what you get from denitrification. So you can actually quantify denitrification. And of course, you could also say that this was spring snowmelt recharge, in which case your recharge temperature is going to be really cold, and you can't get there from here. So this obviously has to be a warmer recharge temperature. And if you go straight over until you get to the equilibrium line, you know, it's still got to recharge at something like 17 degrees centigrade. So you can kind of, and that's why I call this also kind of an art. You have to kind of have a feel for your groundwater system, have a feel for what's possible in terms of recharge temperatures, and then what you do is you correct these numbers using that experience to a realistic level, and you, in general, you don't correct anything unless you have to. And then you come up with excess nitrogen gas, which then you convert back into nitrate to come up with the original total nitrate concentration in a groundwater sample. So the great thing about groundwater age-gating using these techniques is you get all this nitrogen information. And if you have these all this nitrogen information and you have the age of the groundwater, you can put together a nitrogen mass balance and start to look at land use contributions to any particular groundwater. And I think I'm going to skip the rest of the slides and just let Rich give you an example of how he used that in the Cold Spring area.
Become a potato farmer. Okay, I'm just going to kind of very briefly describe how we can use some of this information to actually come up with a fate and transport model for nitrate that we can use in wellhead protection. I'm going to tell you a little bit. Which one, Mickey? There we go. About Cold Spring. Cold Spring, Minnesota is located in Stearns County. We'll get to that in a minute. 1998, nitrate in the city wells increased to about 8 parts per million. We allowed them to put some new wells quite a distance up gradient, but in the same aquifer because, frankly, they don't have any other choice. They've got sand and gravel, and they've got granite, and that's about it. In 2005, the city wells that were downtown, city wells 1 and 2, the original wells, went over 10 and were taken out of production. Couldn't use them anymore. Now, the nitrate in the wells that they put in, the new well field, is ranging from 5 to about 9 parts per million. So it's an issue. They're going to have to either spend a lot of money for a denitrification plant, or they're going to have to somehow manage their wellhead protection area in a way that will bring the nitrate levels down to a reasonable level. Where's Cold Spring? There's Stearns County. There's Stearns County again, and you can see a little red box. That's the general area of Cold Spring. And there's Cold Spring, Minnesota on the Sauk River. Now, I know I don't have to tell most of you about where Cold Spring is because it also happens to be the location of one of Minnesota's longest producing breweries. And as geologists, you all know where the breweries are. And I think this elevates the whole question of the nitrate in Cold Spring to an entirely higher level. Because if we don't resolve this issue, we may not see peace in our time. So what are the goals that we're really trying to accomplish here? There's a couple of things we're trying to do. We're trying to estimate the future nitrate concentration at these city wells. We're also trying to use this information to identify areas where the city can focus their resources to reduce the nitrogen inputs. They're anticipating spending money to do this because they would anticipate spending money to put in a nitrate treatment plant, which isn't the big expense. The expense to them in the long run is the operation and maintenance of that plant, which goes on literally forever. And then another thing is maybe to identify, that was the middle one, some areas where maybe we could put in a well and expect to get lower nitrogen. So the approach is we're going to follow this. You'll see this slide a couple times. First, I got to develop a groundwater flow model because in wellhead protection, that's what we do. Then we're going to estimate the ambient denitrification rate using some old information that I found in a file. Then find the nitrogen loading rate for the different land uses that are out there, partially based on the work that has been done in Perm, that Tim was doing in Perm. And then using these nitrate concentrations, or we're going to use that information to determine the nitrate concentrations at the wells by looking at how much nitrate is coming in the capture area, how long it takes for that to move to the wells, and how much denitrification occurs during that time period. So it's a simple mass balance approach. Here's the general geology here. We have at the bottom there are the municipal wells 1 and 2 that are no longer used. And north of that are the city wells that are really kind of having trouble right now. Here's a couple of cross sections just because we're geologists. The one at the top, the A to A prime, is kind of down the channel. Okay, we have an outwash channel that's present there. It's completely surrounded by tills. That outwash, so we have primarily the flow is in that outwash channel, more or less from the north to the south. And that's what you see on A to A prime. B to B prime is across from west to east across the channel, on which you can see the gray, meaning the till, the yellow is the sandy areas, and you can see that on either side of the channel, there are till layers that we have perched water on. That is, we have water that's essentially going through the sand and gravel, hitting that perched layer, and is entering the aquifer at that point. So they represent focused recharge boundaries. This is the entire groundwater model. The heavy red line that you can see on the inside identifying the channel is really a no-flow boundary. You can see there's a little bit of an island in the middle of that, and that's because that portion of it has till that comes up and is above the water table surface. The Sauk River is down at the bottom right-hand corner, and that represents a head-specified boundary, which is the water level of the river. Then you have those kind of bluish areas, sort of off to the side here. And those are the areas that are not saturated, but have clay surfaces that slope down to the channel deposit. So you have, those are the areas in which they're contributing water by focused recharge along this boundary. And so those are represented in the model as a fixed flow boundary that's coincident with the no-flow boundary. Everybody with me? No? Yes? Kelton, what's the question?
Do you have a lot of control
in all these structures? Oh, for the geologic, the slope? Nah, I guessed. No, I mean, yeah, you have, because what you have here is you have the sand and gravel was deposited sort of as a blanket. Okay, and so you find a fairly consistent thickness. So, in fact, topography does really help give you an idea of where the breaks would be. Okay, no more discussion on the flow model because we have more to cover. Whoops, wrong thing. Here we go. So from that, I have essentially two modeled scenarios. We have at the bottom there the for wells 1 and 2, this is the capture area. They're color-coded by the amount of time it takes for those areas to reach the wells. And one of them is for conditions at 1999, and that's going to be important. And the other is for essentially current conditions. And what changes? Well, the pumping rates change to some extent, but that's primarily the main difference is the pumping rates. Obviously, in 1990 or in today, we're not using the wells down here because they're no longer in operation. Okay, so we take, that's essentially, okay, we got the flow model sort of nailed down. And we can kind of look at, whoops, that doesn't matter. So here we go, got the groundwater flow model. Now we're going to try to estimate the denitrification rate. There were several monitoring wells that were put in near wells 1 and 2, the production wells 1 and 2, and in the folder I found age dating and dissolved gases from that, from these different wells that are located here. We have a nest of wells at different depths, and from that I could get the amount of roughly the age and the amount of excess nitrogen beyond what Tim was talking about, beyond just what we'd expect to be trapped in there. So I have a date and I have an excess nitrogen. Okay. So you plot those babies on a line. Now just for those of you who can't see the data points, look at that. At the bottom we have the groundwater age. Here we have the amount of nitrate nitrogen degraded, or the amount of nitrogen gas produced. Now, I don't know about you, but, you know, I plot a lot of things, and, you know, then I do that. A miracle occurs, and I get this wonderful correlation coefficient, which, you know, is I'm starting to believe. And a denitrification rate of about 0.65 milligrams per liter per year. Now, what they found at Perham was about, I think it was about half, okay, so it was about 0.5 milligrams per liter per year. But we heard earlier today, these rates in comparison to that, those rates, those degradation rates we heard about in the, from North Dakota or even one at Perham, were anywhere between 30 and 45 times higher than what these rates are. Who knows? The other thing to notice is that we actually have an intercept here at about 2 years, and I interpret that as perhaps being the amount of time that it takes for the oxygen to get removed, because you're not going to have denitrification occurring while the oxygen is present. Okay, now we have the denitrification rate. Finally, we need to find what those nitrogen loading rates are for the different land uses. And what I did is I started basically with what they found at Perham. We have all these different sources. Oop, back. Oop, yeah, there we go. So he basically broke it down into these 5 groups: residential and transport, cropland, pasture grass, forest, and water and wetlands. And found, backed out from this approach, which is independent of actually measuring it in the groundwater. This is a mass method from actually measuring the amount of nitrogen that goes in and measuring the amount of nitrogen that comes out. And he came up with these numbers. So I thought, okay, let's start with those. Just to give you a kind of an idea of what we're trying to do here is, we don't know exactly what those nitrogen loading rates are in my area because I don't have the money to go and do a study like that. So I'm going to try to use my 1999 results from those wells, which I know what the total amount of nitrogen is at the city wells, and I have a rough idea of what the loading rates are for the different land uses, and see if they agree or see if they need to be adjusted. So essentially, it's this concept where you're just looking at the flow of the groundwater down towards the well. You're watching as the groundwater changes from green, meaning nitrogen, to blue with less nitrogen in it. And you're looking at the travel times from the wells. So, for instance, it's working that math at each one of these different sections to figure out what each one is contributing and what you would expect to see at the city wells. So it's a calibration process. This is the 10-year, well, no, it's the capture area, really, for city wells 1 and 2. Now, I'm also going to note that, remember those focused recharge areas where the water was coming off the clay and then entering the aquifer at that point? I don't have those drawn in here because it's just too complicated, but it does include those. So they have, wherever they enter the aquifer, that's when they begin to move. So that's when their clock gets started. Now, the same capture areas with the different land uses. Okay, so now I have the capture area, so I know the time. I have the land use. I have a rough idea of what the nitrogen input rate is. So I can, for each one of those areas, those discretized areas, which are of both time and of land use, I can then begin to do mass balance to see what my nitrogen concentration should be at City Well 2. It's a simple mathematical model, which I'm not going to go into, but you just add them up and you should come up with a number that's reasonable or not. And you sort of have to play with the numbers a little bit to let it make sense. Now, the playing with the numbers part, this is what they came up with at Perham, right there. This is what I came up for Cold Spring in 1999. The numbers were adjusted a little bit for 2010 by the same method that they did at Perham. That is, you know that a certain amount of fertilizer is being sold in a county. You can see how that changes through time. It's increasing. So you adjust it based purely on that. And down here, these inputs, forest, the grassland, the wetland, weren't changed. They were held constant because why should they be any different in Cold Spring than they were at Perham? But for cultivated land, well, I know that I have a lot of manure applied, at Cold Spring. That's one of the things that they do. And I know that they don't do that at Perham because it's mostly potatoes, and they don't like putting manure on a potato field because it might carry some pathogens that'll create a problem for them later. So I'm expecting my Cold Spring numbers to be a little bit higher. Now, one thing I want you to notice here is that for each one of these, I have two columns. One of them is the nitrogen loading rate, okay, which is a function just purely of the mass, and the other is the expected milligrams per liter of the infiltrating water. And that will vary depending upon how much infiltration there is. There's more infiltration occurring in Cold Spring than there was at Perm. So you can see the numbers actually turned out to be pretty similar, except that I really had to increase this urban and industrial footprint quite a bit higher than what they saw at Perm in order for this to make sense, because quite a bit of the land very close to the city wells is this urban and industrial area. Plus, I have a feedlot that's located here. I know there's not supposed to be any here. They're all in Wisconsin, but there was one, and these concentrations that I came up with, I just didn't pull them out of the sky. I pulled that out of a report that the MPCA had done on some closed feedlots to evaluate what their impacts were. So I was using that as my guidance for those numbers. But in essence, the numbers look pretty similar. Okay. So now with that, we've got the nitrogen loading rates. Now the fun begins, and actually we're almost done because we have our capture areas at wells 3, 4, and 5, and now we're looking at now, okay, and not 1999 anymore, but now. So here's our capture areas. There's our land use that's associated with that. You work your way down the travel times, okay, down the capture areas, and you look at what the mass of nitrogen is that's entering. You track how much is being lost through denitrification as it's moving down towards the city wells. Now, one thing I should explain is that these city wells, unlike the way most cities do, where they have one and then they switch to the other and then they switch to the third, these had been operating together at the same time. So when they pump, they all three pump together, which means then that their capture areas are distinct. There's not a lot of mixing that's occurring near the wells. So the capture areas and the concentrations that we're getting from these wells should actually be representative somewhat of these land use areas upstream. Oops, doggone it. And this is what I got for a result. Well number four, the observed value, the measured value was 9.5. Came up with 9.2. Well, 5, 6.4, 5.8. 6, 3.4, 4.5. It's pretty good agreement, especially since, I've always been told that you can't model nitrates, but I think you can. The only other thing, I guess, whoa, what happened here? The end. Well, okay, that's the end then. The only other thing I was going to say, just quickly, to follow up on this, there's some things we can do. We can use this information to try to help design a little bit better monitoring system out there, to be able to put some additional wells in and try to take a look at what's going on, you know, upstream, to try to identify specifically, because everybody knows that, you know, one field is going to be operated different than another field. So we try to do that. Another thing we're going to try to do is to maybe take a look at the nitrogen isotope signatures, try to identify how much of this nitrogen is perhaps from manure and from inorganic sources. And there was a third thing, but I forgot. I will not answer that man's questions.